Welcome back to the Coaches Rising podcast. Today I'm joined by Peter Lindberg, which is fantastic because Peter actually hasn't been doing podcasts for a number of years. He agreed to come on this podcast and I was honored and a little nervous, wanted to do him justice, but I think this is a really fantastic conversation. Peter is a brilliant writer. I highly recommend his Substack, Less Foolish. And he is the steward of The Stoa, which is an online gathering for, I'd say, you know, creatives, brilliant thinkers, mischievers, people kind of making sense of what's emerging in the world. Check that out on YouTube. He's also a practical philosopher, which is the main focus of our conversation today. So we're going to talk about what is practical philosophy, why is it so relevant for our times, what makes it different from coaching and therapy, and what are some of the key frames that Peter brings to his practice? What are some of the key moves he makes, and why are they so effective? If you want to know more about Peter's work, you can head to peterlindberg.com, or you can head to his Substack, which is Less Foolish. All right, so that all being said, let's dive in. Here's the podcast with Peter Lindberg. I don't have to tell you that these are turbulent times. They're astonishing times. Many people are feeling deeply challenged, more reactive, and my sense is in more need of coaching than ever. And while these times are full of challenges, they're also ripe with evolutionary potential. This is the gift of these times. And I think it's these moments that coaches are built for. So we can help our clients unlock the deeper capacities and intelligence that's required of them now. And that's exactly what our newest program, Unlocking Leaders, is all about. You'll learn how to work at the source code of change, beyond strategy, beyond protocol, at the level of consciousness itself. This, for me, has been by far the biggest leverage I have with my clients. It's the most potent move I can make. Because the level of consciousness a leader is operating from determines everything. What they notice, what they miss, whether they react defensively, stay grounded, whether they tighten in control or open into creativity and collaborativity, and ultimately what becomes possible in how they lead. And when you work at this level, you'll be able to tap into these hidden drivers behind decisions and behaviors and unlock possibilities in situations that once felt stuck. And beyond that, importantly, you're going to cultivate a capacity that AI will never possess. As AI expands and begins to dominate procedural and operational coaching, as it grows, it's becoming clearer what it cannot do. And it can't feel, it can't connect in the same way when two human beings come together and the field that they create becomes part of the transformational conversation. It can't work with consciousness, the very source of transformation and the source of the most powerful coaching moves. This is what separates good coaches from great coaches working at this level. And AI can't touch this. So if you're interested to find out more about this program, if you feel called to join us, then head to coachesrising.com/leaders to book your spot. The first class is June 16th with Jim Dethmer, just an incredible, masterful coach. And he's joined by Bob Anderson, also a true pioneer in the field of conscious leadership and coaching. And if you sign up by May 29th, you can get the early bird discount. Enrollment is open until June 12th. So head to coachesrising.com/leaders to book your spot. So Peter, yeah, it's a real privilege. As we were just kind of checking in before hitting the record button, I was sharing it's a real honor to have you on the podcast because I know you've been on a hiatus. And, you know, I do want to share this with the audience. Like I just highly recommend people check out your Substack and your work and your thinking. Yeah, it's my favorite Substack. I shared that with you. I just want to presence that right at the start. So I'm super excited to be in conversation with you today.
Yeah, likewise, my friend. I had this resistance on going on podcasts for years. I was like saying no to all of them, but I felt called to accept your extended invite to go on the Coaches Rising podcast. A, because it's an amazing podcast, and I feel like whatever I'm holding, whatever piece I'm holding with this coaching conversation, I feel like some clarity or insight will emerge in dialogue with you.
Actually, what comes to me as you say that is what I've appreciated about discovering your work and our conversations, our time together, is the way you are making very powerful discernments about how you see the state of the coaching industry, this notion of friendships of virtue, which we can, I've done a podcast on that and we could unpack it, but the distinction between therapy, coaching, and practical philosophy, which we're going to spend most of our conversation on. Because, something I'm really keen on exploring is like how are our practices being invited to evolve, to adapt in our times? And, what ways do we hold who we are, that kind of, in a sense, afford certain possibilities and close down others? So, yeah, I mean, maybe I've named now friendships of virtue. Could you just, like, to people listening, say, in a sense, like what you were thinking around that?
So that phrase, friendships of virtue, comes from Aristotle, and he has a tripartite understanding of friendships. So on one hand, there's friendships of pleasure. You come together with someone and you have a good time, essentially. So this could be like a drinking buddy, in a modern understanding. And he contrasts that with friendships of utility. Friendly relationships that have some kind of common goal or purpose. So this could be like a friendly coworker or a business partner. And he says the most rare form of friendship is the third category, friendships of virtue, where it's not based off pleasure or what kind of goal you're aiming to achieve. It's a friendship and a relationship based off the cultivation of goodness itself. So there's like a third thing in the middle of the relationship that they're oriented to, virtue, moral excellence. And there doesn't seem that much places today in popular society that cultivates virtue or has a chance for friends of virtue to meet. So it's almost like a mythical concept, it feels like right now, but it's something that I've been called to find and cultivate and ready myself for basically my entire adult life. There's sort of like an existential hunger I have to find these types of friends and become one myself.
Yeah, amazing. And could you say, because that speaks to me greatly, especially in our times where, it does feel like we're moving through some kind of passage, some rite of passage in some way. We've got these things called coaches and guides and therapists, and I wrestle sometimes with, being a coach, making a living being a coach, the benefits I see from the work I do with my clients, but at the same time, wrestling with like how do I position myself, and also like we're kind of ensconced within this capitalist economic system which has some challenges within it. And if we are, and we're going to get onto wisdom in a moment, but if I care about that too, how might this all be wanting to evolve in order to kind of proliferate wisdom? I mean, you may not even hold it that way, but yeah, I mean, that's a difficult question I just asked you, so.
It's a good one. And what's coming up for me is sort of a historical confusion I had on what coaching is versus what therapy is versus what philosophy or practical philosophy is, which we can discuss in a moment. And there's this that holding space concept. That's kind of like popular in therapeutic circles. It's like kind of fully being present with someone while embodying what Carl Rogers might call the unconditional positive regard, kind of like non-judgment, accepting the person who they are as a starting point. So like holding space. And In my understanding, there's like different ways to hold space. Like a therapist holds space, a coach holds space, so does the practical philosopher. They hold space for someone. But then their orientation is a little bit different. And so one of my, I guess, theoretical projects was to kind of delineating the differences between those types of space holding, because they all feel important in their own way. And they all seem to risk foolishness if they overextend, their boundaries, and sort of in relationship to the market economy as well, that kind of can create that foolishness. And I know I was enriched by engaging with coaches, with therapists, and with practical philosophers. We can stick with those three. Like, those are the therapists and coaches are the big two most popular today. And then I think practical philosophy is growing in popularity, and the title there would be philosophical counselor. People who engage in a philosophical inquiry with similar subject matter as a therapist or a coach, like something that is of importance to the person. So just kind of teasing out these kind of different inquiry genres, if you will, has been a project of mine. And I would say these are almost like placeholders for being a friend of virtue, because I think a true friend of virtue will have the talent stack that a coach has, that a therapist has, that a philosophical counselor has. And in my practice, even though I bias toward the practical philosophy or philosophical counseling, that's my like starting point. I want to be like a Swiss Army knife of inquiry. I want to have all these capacities of the coach, of the therapist, of the practical philosopher. Yeah, maybe I'll pause there and see what
Well, I love that. I think we've mentioned, like, well, at least the call to like cross paradigmatic practice that I've felt, and I've shared that phrase with you. My friend coined like mixed mystical arts, you know. So, like, the value in being able to not just be kind of specialized in one area, but be, you know, bring in kind of the best of therapy and counseling and. You know, I think that's something I'm learning more about, but the best of coaching and therapy. And so, like, I'm sat with, as AI comes in, and you know, already the number one seems like the number one use of AI is like a kind of guide or a coach or a therapist, which, you know, I'm not sure how I feel about that. I feel mixed about that, but it seems like there may be a place in the future where, on the one hand, there are people who like dedicate their life to mastering these arts, you know, because and actually there is some kind of financial remuneration needed to support that endeavor. But on the other hand, you know, if it only stays within that kind of field, that is limited, that there's a way this can proliferate more through these friendships of virtue on a broader level, and that, you know, there's a kind of, you know, and I don't want to get into like kind of saying how the world will go. I have no idea, but yeah, these kind of friendships of flourishing of virtue, because it touches me when you say it, like that, in our times, wow, like you dedicated your whole life to this, you know? And I was touched because I was like, man, that's a friend I want, you know, in these times, like someone who's, you know, gone to the depths inside of themselves in this journey and an orient to life in this way.
And it's like my hope, my dream, my vision is that these skills become so common that it's like emancipated from the market economy, from a specialized training, and people can grow up and they get educated. The schooling system educates people how to be a coach for another, how to be a therapist for another, how to be a philosopher for another. Because part of this desire, longing for a friend of virtue and to be one is this existential loneliness in a way. Like, how it's overused in this therapy speak, but like being seen. And there's a lack of that, a great lack of that with a lot of my, a lot of people around me. And when you reach a certain level sort of personal complexity of all the inner work you do, and it just gets lonelier. And And it's great that we have people who we can, pay money for in the market to help see us and help us and heal us. But it would be great that if our family members could do it or if our closest friends could do it. So it is actually a radical vision in that sense, but it's one that I feel called to work toward.
Yeah, inspiring. Well, we might pick that up a bit further, but I think I'd just love to get into philosophical counseling and what that actually is, because I've experienced it with you, and it was a fantastic experience. And could you tell us what it is, really? Because I know you make this difference between theoretical and practical philosophy. And your Substack's called Less Foolish, and so how come? And let's kind of get into that.
So philosophy, kind of like coaching, they call it the jingle jangle problem. It's a word that has many different definitions or understandings or just kind of a sense of what it is. And then people tend to project things on it, understandably so. And so, the etymology of philosophy, of course, is the love of wisdom. That's what it means, and I kind of take that quite literally. It's actually the love of wisdom, which begs the question: what is wisdom? And there's many different definitions. And it's interesting if you ask, there were academic philosophers were surveyed about what the aim of philosophy is. And then wisdom was not at the top spot. It was like truth or understanding or something like that, right? And so psychologists actually are more interested in the construct of wisdom. And so there's various different definitions of what it is. I like existential wayfinding, finding one's way and the way in life. So that's my provisional definition of wisdom. And the opposite of wisdom is foolishness. And you can say it's existential way losing, meaning losing one's way or the way in life. And I'm using the word existential here, not as existentialism, the philosophy of Camus or Sartre, but just like existential is something of deep importance to one's being. And so the name of the Substack is Less Foolish. So kind of the move there is instead of trying to become more wise, become its opposite, less foolish, which hopefully gives wisdom a chance. And that value of less foolishness is the basis of my inquiry practice, essentially. So now that we got like a definition, a provisional definition of philosophy, the love of wisdom, and understanding of what wisdom is, you can bifurcate. And Aristotle, again, bringing him up, he bifurcated philosophy into theoretical philosophy and practical philosophy. You can say they're two modes of philosophy, and they have different subject matter. So theoretical philosophy focuses on like something that's abstract and universal, and practical philosophy focuses the subject matter similar to a therapist or coach. It's something very situated and personal, and the orientations are different as well. So theoretical philosophy is oriented towards the true, the good, true, and beautiful, the transcendentals. Like, so it's the true is the orientation, where practical philosophy is the good. And they have like emergent outcomes. And I say emergent because it's not like intended. It's just sort of because when you're truly in a state of philosophizing, there's a perplexity or like a what they call aporia. There's a state of unknowingness. So it's not like a clear destination. That's not what doing philosophy is. But there is emergent outcomes with both. Basically, with theoretical philosophy, there's conceptual clarity that hopefully leads to wise thinking, or I should say the potential of conceptual clarity. Where practical philosophy, there's the potential of again existential clarity, meaning what's important to one's life, that hopefully enables wise action. And when people think about philosophy, many think it's synonymous with theoretical philosophy. So most philosophy that happens in academia, like professional philosophers, is like pretty much theoretical philosophy. And even the para-academic philosophers, see people talk on philosophy about YouTube or whatever, it's mostly theoretical philosophy if they go under the banner of philosophy. And they're usually talking and piggybacking on the thinking and theories of, the people in the philosophical canon, like Descartes, Hegel, Nietzsche. And that's good for what it is, the theoretical philosophy, but it's not practical philosophy. And there was something that kind of started emerging around the 1980s, called the practical philosophy movement. And this is where philosophical counselors were born. And so it's like, how can we bring philosophy to, I shouldn't say to the people, but how do we bring philosophy in a way that is relevant to someone's life? And so let's say, like in the archetypal sense, like say a coach is someone who helps someone, supports someone accomplishing things in life, like maybe a life coach. And I know, again, there's a jingle-jangle problem with coaches because the people that you interview, if they go under the banner of a coach, they might be doing what the philosopher is doing, the practical philosopher is doing, what I'm about to articulate, or even what the therapist is doing. So I'm just talking more about sort of an abstracted like archetype of what maybe people think of a life coach. And so if a life coach is sort of like externally looking at accomplishing something in the world or moving forward, a therapist is looking within, like the project of self-love, where the philosopher or the practical philosopher, the philosophical counselor, is their starting point is one's worldview, in a way, their understanding of what is and what ought to be. And let's say if the coach has an external focus and the therapist has an internal focus and this sort of model that I'm provisionally operating on, the philosopher has a meta focus and focuses on one's reasoning, cohering one's reasoning, bringing clarity to it. And so while in my practice, I do all three of those things, external, internal, and then meta, I usually start with kind of the meta, the one's reasoning, one's worldview, and then we kind of move from there.
What makes that powerful to work with the meta view? I mean, I'm hearing you already speak to that in a way, but it might be good to kind of unpack that further.
And so one kind of definition of wisdom is from Igor Grossman. He's actually in Toronto. He's a psychologist, and he says wisdom is the meta value that adjudicates between all other values. So it's like if imagine if you had like an ecology of values. And I really like Joe Edelman's definition of value as an attentional protocol. So it's something that puts like horse blinders on you, and then you're like, okay, I want to pursue this, whether it's like success, happiness, health. Where wisdom is the meta value, we can kind of zoom up and see all the values at play, and then sort of choose the one that's most appropriate for the moment. And so if one is truly in a philosophical inquiry, they have that meta perspective. And the art form there, and the one people also call philosophy is the art of living, the art form there is not to prematurely choose a value. And so the challenge with if you're just operating on a specific coaching modality or a specific therapeutic modality, and someone comes with to you for a challenge, it's like a category error could form if that's the only thing you do, or you're trying to force fit someone's issue or challenge, or what I call an existential knot. I'm using the word existential a lot today because, as you can see, I'm pretty fond of it. It's to kind of force someone's issue into that modality, into that, and that modality sort of protects and hones a certain value, whether it's healing or whether it's accomplishment or whether it's something else. And so I like having starting with a sort of that philosophical disposition at the beginning of an inquiry. And oftentimes I pivot to more of a coaching, traditional coaching way, or pivot to some a therapeutic, like you weave between the different modalities, or the genres, I should say. But I feel like philosophy gives you the best perspective of what value to honor in an inquiry.
That's really interesting, I think. So, can you give us a sense of how that plays out when you meet someone for to explore together, and they start to share what's up for them. Like, what's happening in you in that moment? You know that you're yeah, because I think this is an issue, and this is in a sense like the mixed mystical arts. I think is you're speaking into this now where. If you only know internal family systems and that's every, you see everything through that lens, is that appropriate? Is that what's best going to serve this person in this moment? So, there's a stepping back where one can select what might be the appropriate path. But in a sense, I'm hearing even more than that from you. And so, yeah, around long way to get back to the question of like, what's happening for you in that moment where you're listening to that person and you're kind of sensing in.
And there's something about I gestured at this before about how philosophy has to be goalless in a way. And there's I wrote this entry that I sent you about like the 10 techniques that I use. The first one I mentioned was Socratic ignorance. It's basically being ignorant to what is actually happening, like why we're here in this conversation, and not prematurely jumping to a conclusion of what this person needs. And when I've done that in the past, first it never really feels right on the subtle level, the felt sense level. It's like when that feeling when you have like a puzzle piece, like two puzzle pieces click, right? And it's like it's like there's something right about that. It's almost like you're kind of forcing. They almost fit, but you're kind of forcing it a little bit. So that's sort of the embodied sense of like rushing to some kind of solution or a mode of being. And so yeah, it has that ignorance. Like I don't really know what's happening with this person and what the real issue is. And they might think they know, but they probably don't as well. Hence, they're here talking to me, or hence why they're talking to me. And yeah, it's and this ignorance is quite important, just to kind of like allow what wants to unfold. And there's something else here that it's interesting just talking about ignorance is just putting me in a state of like a blank mind and ignorance. But I'm not, I'm curious if that answers your question or if that
Yeah, it's helpful. And I'm going to refer to when we did a session together a while back, which is, I found it to be like a, how to put this, like, it was a whole being experience, which tapped into the kind of integration of my, like, how I structured my world with the beliefs and the emotional underpinning and the embodied, shaping of these beliefs. And so as you share about this kind of ignorance, I love this because I think there's a kind of maturity in it where I think, coaches who often listen to this or practitioners, it's like, yeah, in the early stages, it's often easy to kind of, you want to serve your client, you want to do well. There's a kind of, maybe you're even still fused with being valuable. So there's a kind of desire to help. And then but that's kind of following a very particular thread, which may or may not be the right one. And so I like this idea of ignorance. And I'm wondering as well, because we can talk about existential knots and some of the other injunctions. I printed it out, by the way. I recommend people listening go, because it's really useful. Is this kind of also like an intuitive kind of thing? I love kind of like stretching out with people I speak to, like what's happening for them in that moment. Is it like you're kind of like just trying to get a sense of this topic by being innocent with them in a sense, and yeah, feeling into it. Yeah.
And I love what you just said about sort of the coach or therapist wanting to be useful. And that sort of relates to the sort of the premature sort of orientation of what this person needs for in order for me to be of service to them. And if there's anything unexamined with me, if there's any fear in my systems, like I got to be useful for this person because I want them as a client. I want like either them to sign up for my 5-session package, or I want to have a regular thing, or my cash flow is kind of like, I'm kind of like feeling anxiety about it this month. So I really need to have this person. If there's any sort of like unconscious layer there, and you start sort of objectifying and making outcomes of the relationship, then it's like that philosophy is no longer there. And so this is one of my struggles of putting philosophy in the market economy. I originally started my practice about 5 years ago in the gift economy, solely, and it felt more of a natural fit there. And I kind of weave between the economies now. I have a market economy offering and then the gift economy. But there's a challenge there because that fear and anxiety can creep up. So I basically, like, even though I have a good client, some great clients right now, I purposely, consciously don't rely on this practice to support my livelihood. I've made that decision. Like, I can't do it. A, because I don't even know what it is fully. I'm still working that through. But B, I don't want to put it in a position that would compromise its integrity. And yeah, I think that's it. When you have that fear, then you kind of like you assume what this person needs. And so to answer your question that you just asked, firstly, I discovered this way of practical philosophy, doing it, I think in 2013, because I was a I did academic philosophy, and it was like dispirited. I was like, this is a philosophy, and then I fell in love with Stoicism, which I discovered outside of my studies in the academy. But it was only until I met Andrew Tagart, who I consider my philosophical mentor, who does philosophical counseling, is a practical philosopher, that like, wow, this is philosophy. This is what it really is. And so I've been doing that way of philosophizing, with myself and my journaling, with friends, and then eventually in my more formalized practice. And so I share that because it's just like intuitively winging it, really, based off of that experience, that encounter I had with Andrew. And it's really thanks to this invitation to go on the Coaches Rising podcast that I forced, like, it was a forcing function to write this series on the actual techniques of the practice. And they're like, oh wow, this is actually pretty coherent, and I can talk about this. And so the fundamental disposition, I think the big three, is that Socratic ignorance, is like that state of unknowingness, or what they call aporia. You just kind of like, you don't know the answer. And two is questions, the Socratic questioning. You ask a question, ask another question. Really, if you're uncertain with something, what the other person is saying, they're probably uncertain with it as well, whether they how they define a word or a concept. A lot of time people speak when there's a certainty. It's almost like a red herring to kind of like distract you from what was really going on. And then when I feel that in my body, it's like, okay, something's off here. And then a good question, a loving question, really reveals that. So ignorance, questions, and the other one I would say is attunement, or poetic attunement, which our friend Steve March on the Unfoldment Coaching, I think he really nails this description of a poetic attunement. And it's basically a disposition where you orient yourself to the transcendentals, the good, true, and beautiful, or what you feel is good, the goodness in yourself and the other, what you believe is true or sense is true, and then what feels beautiful. And you don't even need a theoretical, strong understanding of either of those words. Just like a felt sense of them would do is good enough. And attuning yourself to that. And so that's basically what Andrew did. That's basically what I've been doing all these years without having a name to it. And so I think what makes a practical philosophical inquiry is those three fundamental techniques: the ignorance, the questioning, and the attunement.
First of all, that I want to say something about the kind of confluence of those, but the questioning, it's like that is such a good one, and I've seen a lot of coaches who, it sounds so simple, but it's so powerful. It's like when people, someone did this to me earlier today. I was like talking about authority, and then they were just, oh, what do you, that word, interesting, that word stands out, Joel. Like, what do you mean by that? And because it, I just said it, not in a blasé way, but it just came out in the thing I was saying. But that took us deep into such a rich territory, to keep following that. So, and as I hear you talk about these three modes of being with clients, it's like it really is in line for me with what I see emerging in the field of coaching. And in a way, like this gets to the, I like the jingle jangle kind of idea you came with, because I feel like the word coach is too small in the way it's been defined. And so, like what is a coach these days? I feel oriented towards the cultivation of wisdom as being much more of a rewarding endeavor than being successful, which a lot of coaching is. But what I'm trying to say is that I hear in these three ways of being, like what I see emerging in the coaching field, this orientation towards the, this unfolding sense of being with people rather than making an assessment quickly and then trying to close the gap between where they are now and where their ideal future is. And it's not that we can't tap into people's deepest longings, and I mean we absolutely must, like but that it's a particular way that we do that, and we hold it. So I feel your work ensconced within this emerging edge in the field of coaching. So I'm appropriating you for into the field of coaching.
Yeah, I love it. And we've had conversations about this, about the title, and I think the wisest coaches today, or the people who call themselves coaches, are basically practical philosophers in the way I understand it, in the sense that they love wisdom. It's just the term coach is the most legible term in the market economy right now. So if you want to have some clients, then that's probably the wisest one to go to, where something like philosophical counselor is quite niche and less legible in the market economy. So there's sort of like a strategic reason to adopt that term. But when we have a philosophical inquiry about like what it actually is, then it's like leads to like interesting things. And in my sense is the direction of it is really ultimately a friend of virtue.
Yeah, 100%. Well, can we talk about some of the other principles? Because we've talked about the existential and the existential knots. And could you say what you mean by, you have this phrase, I think, tracing the X knot, and yeah.
And so I think, and this is all provisional. And so this podcast and writing those articles was a great help, sort of making it more clear and explicit of what I do and my go-to moves. After those sort of like fundamental dispositions, the thing that I asked clients to bring forward is what I call a existential knot, or just simply a knot. And I defined a knot. Let's see if I could pull it up. Being deeply confused about something that feels deeply important without feeling like you can ar accurately articulate what the confusion or importance is. And even if someone thinks that they know what the issue is, after a few Socratic and questioning inquiry, and just like it gets that state of annoyingness, aporia, and they have that ignorance of like, yeah, what is actually bothering me here? But they feel it. Something is bothering them. And I like the visual of a knot because I actually feel the knot, like in between us. And you can feel the contours of it. And it's like they're all knotted up. There's like thought loops, mental models, emotional, like complex motions that they're not meeting. And it's all kind of tied together. And so what I do is I trace the knot, like how one would trace an actual knot to find the thread to pull on to help loosen it. And what I do initially in an inquiry is just ask them to free associate about what's bothering them, what their existential knot is, and really get the contours of it. And it's like kind of the basic facts of their situation and life, the emotions involved, just tease them forward just enough to feel it in my body. And then the other one would be, their beliefs about their situation, their story, or like, their premises and their proposition in the philosophical sense. And then if they have any provisional plans to resolve the situation. And after I get a sense of their X knot, that could be just the end of the inquiry itself. I could take the whole inquiry, and then that's just all they might need. It's the beginning, and then things get interesting, and then that's and here's the like the jumping point for what people might think of as a philosophical inquiry, because the theoretical aspect starts emerging after I trace one's X naught.
Just say more about what you mean there. Like it sounds like when you get to that, you've kind of presenced the X knot and its different kind of flavors, and then I get the sense then that that opens up a certain possibility. And I wasn't quite sure what you meant by the theoretical and practical distinction there.
Right, right,
Maybe it's
right.
not even that important, but yeah.
Let's see if I can articulate it without using those words. And so once the X knot is traced and I have a good sense of its contours, if the person, just seeing the person in their complexity could be enough, like I mentioned. But if it feels like there's something more for me to be of service in that inquiry, then I usually inquire into their worldview. And it could be something as simple as asking them to define a word that they're using. So this is the I think the fourth technique I mentioned in that article you're referencing. I call it base definitions. And so sometimes when so I got a sense of the person's issue, there's a word that's sort of like drawing my attention. And that word feels like it's like lifting a lot. Like more than what it be should be lifting, and so I just ask them what it means, whether the word is like love or power or like whatever it could be. Like what's the word that authority that the one that you mentioned earlier, right? And when you ask them how to define it, then they say like they start stumbling a little bit. Then like maybe examples more than an actual definition emerge. And some inquiries is just it's all about defining a word and like really getting coherent on what it is. And I like not just having kind of it making logical sense of what the word means, but also the word if the word resonates, the definition of the word resonates in your body. That to me is like that kind of that puzzle piece, two puzzle pieces clicking. Once you get to a definition, it just resonates as true. It's like, oof, oof, that's it. Then it was kind of like that could be the end of the inquiry itself too, or more could be needed. But that's sort of what I mean by like after understanding the X naught, then we kind of go into the person's worldview and understanding of what is actually true.
Yeah, beautiful. Yeah, it has this sense of like there's an alchemical process to refining or exploring that word, and it's not just a word. It's like the word is a portal into the client's embodied experience. And so why I say alchemy is that in kind of pursuing that, following that, entering that portal, there's a kind of reordering, or like a kind of something coming back into place or into clarity.
Totally. Totally.
Yeah. Why? I mean, that I think this is really important. And what's going on there? Do you think that we just inherit, notions of what some of these things are, or that we just don't examine our on a deeper level, like the way we're constructing our world. And so there's a kind of, yeah, there's great value in actually unpacking that. What makes that transformational for you?
The way I phrase it is you own your words, you own your philosophy. If you own your philosophy, you own your life. And we can kind of like, replace the word ownership with something else, but the spirit of it gets to what I'm hoping to convey there. Because, and this is the challenge with talking to someone who's like one of the theoretical philosophers that I mentioned, like academia or whatever. It's like they sound so impressive but it's like they talk past each other. You can't really have a real conversation because it's Dave Chalmers. He's a philosopher. He calls it there's a difference between verbal disputes and factual disputes. And factual disputes is you actually have a dispute about, factual, like some fact of reality, where verbal disputes or a semantic dispute is that you're just like disagreeing with each other, but it's really you're defining the words differently. And he has something called the method of elimination, where it's like, okay, remove that word from your vocabulary, your mutual vocabulary for a moment, and just describe what you're actually trying to articulate. And maybe it's different things. And then maybe you can kind of like come up with an ad hoc glossary amongst one another. But most people have this sort of egoic attachment to the word, or some kind of arrogance about they actually know it, or that word has some kind of like objective truth, that definition. And the reality is most words are up for negotiation, and they have been throughout history. And so in an inquiry, it's just sort of allowing people to become intimate with the words that they use. And it's like Socrates says, the examined life is not worth living. And most people have not only worldviews or their philosophy that's borrowed, but they borrow the words that they use as well. And so I think this is a book I'm considering writing called Base Definitions of Philosophical Practice, which just we do this. We just sort of like take, let's say, 100 foundational words that are at the basis of your philosophy, and then own them in the sense you create your own definition. Don't rely on the dictionary. Don't rely on ChatGPT. Don't rely on some smart sounding person. Own your own definition in a way that's coherent, logically, and also resonates with your body. It just feels true. And then don't impose that definition on other people. Have a conversation, be in negotiation with it, because they might have a different definition that resonates more. And then you can just tinker it. Maybe it's just a word that needs to be tinkered. So I think this is a overlooked practice in philosophy, and just like in perhaps coaching and therapy in general.
I mean, in life itself, like I get really inspired hearing this. What has this brought you in your life? Like, as you've examined your, in a sense, your personal philosophy or the way you construct your life. What opens up as you do so and you hold that? Basically, could even be what happens with clients as well if they. If they start to actually define what a word or a set of words means to them in a way that resonates, what opens up, or in your own life, if you've been able to define your own philosophy, like what does it bring you? Yeah, I mean, I get a really instinctive sense. I think I have my own sense of like the, it, I just feel a yes in my body to doing that, but. Yeah, just curious.
That's a good question. I feel like for me, it opens things up. It kind of like it's almost especially if you have an unconscious definition or understanding of reality that like contradicts another that you have. And so there's something if there's like an internal contradiction here, then you're sort of being blocked from seeing something. And then kind of cleaning up your thinking and just like getting coherency there in a way that resonates. It's just like a lightness usually emerges for me and the people that I work with, because you can argue that they're looking at reality falsely. And they're looking at reality falsely because they have a wrong word or an ill-defined word. There have been, it's like a category error. They're using that word too broadly. And this perhaps is the word with the word coach, and people are having challenges with the word coach itself. Like, what does this actually mean? And it'd be cool to do this base definition exercise on the word coach, which what I've I did this exercise on the word philosopher, and we kind of went through it. And I coherently gave you the definition, existential wayfinding, what resonates with me, and then how that relates to philosophy, practical philosophy, theoretical philosophy. And so yeah, it feels like you're standing on something firm now.
Yeah, I love this topic. I'm just curious, how would you invite people listening to play around with this themselves? If they feel they're feeling like, oh, this is something I want to play with.
So one thing I recommend regarding the definitions is so I have an article, perhaps you can link it, base definitions that I'm probably going to convert into a book, but there's exercise there on how to go about this, and basically like maybe start with 10 words. It's usually best to start with a word that feels salient to you in the moment, like how authority was for you, or perhaps coaching is becoming for us. And you can open up a Word doc, a Google doc, or get a pen and paper, and just write down a definition. You can look at the dictionary. You can ask ChatGPT. You can look up a philosopher you admire or a thinker you admire and see how they use it. That's good reference points. But come up with your own, and then write it down. If it doesn't feel like that, that puzzle piece clicking, that sensation doesn't happen in your body, write it down again, massage it, and keep working on it. And then maybe add examples, and maybe some theory could emerge behind it. But I think that's the process. And there's more to it that I mentioned in the article. And it's also good to have a space for that. So I have a journal, space meaning kind of like a space that you create. So I write in a specific location every morning, and I write with others at the Stoa, this online place that I run. And we have a collective journaling session every day at 8 a.m. Eastern time for 90 minutes. And that's a space that I just show up, whatever wants to come out of me, whether it's like a public entry I post on my Substack, or whether it's just like something personal I'm like bothered by. Basically, I'm inquiring with myself, and that kind of that container, that space I created. And oftentimes, I'm defining words in that space. Today, we were looking at the word curiosity collectively in collective journaling. So yeah, there's a simple practice for it, and then but that practice will never happen if you don't have kind of a scheduled space to make it happen. And a writing practice, a journaling practice is the practice for that, or inquiry practice with a philosophical counselor.
This is like what I think is very powerful about what you're doing. And I one of like I said, I love your Substack. And when I saw your principles of philosophical counseling or practical philosophy, for me it was like a real window. I was like, oh, right. I'm kind of like getting what Peter's up to now. Because what, why I think this is important for people listening is that if when you train as a coach or a practitioner, it's like you inherit the kind of thinking of that person, which, hopefully if it's a great training, it's not a bad thing to inherit. But the real point of, becoming someone who can hold space for me, and being on this lifelong unfolding is when you start to move beyond whatever you've inherited and you start to fashion your own philosophy, so to speak, and you start to engage in with the world. It's like kind of hyper accelerates the unfolding process because you're now engaged in the way you construct your world, not on an intellectual level, but on a whole being level. That was my experience of being in inquiry with you. It was like this was a full being experience where these words and definitions had a kind of, gnosis to them, like, with a they were laden with felt experience. And so, yeah. So I'm kind of like encouraging people to kind of to engage in something like this, because it will, my sense is it will accelerate your capacity to serve, to be a friend of virtue, to be a great space holder. Yeah, I don't know what comes up if I share that, but
Yeah, 100%, 100%. And it's like I'm actively inquiring with myself. So how I describe practical philosophy, that's what I'm doing when I write a collective journaling, when I'm journaling to myself. And sometimes those are quite private. And I had this, I started journaling when I was 17 or 18, and I trained myself to like delete everything I wrote after I wrote it, if it was a private entry. So I was just basically for me. I only started writing publicly at the beginning of the pandemic. And I was inspired by the framing of, Marcus Aurelius. He's the Stoic, famous Stoic emperor. And his only book is the Meditations, Taas Hutin. Probably mispronouncing that, but that means things to oneself. And so he just wrote a journal in his like war campaigns to remind himself of his truth. And he was inquiring with himself essentially. And he had no intention to publish it as far as I understand, but it was published after his death. And I'm like, yes, that's basically what I want to do. I want to write to myself, but with an awareness that other people will be reading it. But given that I've trained myself to just write to myself and like delete it afterward, that spirit of writing to myself, I feel like it's translated over to my public writing. And so when I show up and there's a blank page in front of me, I'm not quite sure if it's going to be a private or a public entry, but the spirit of philosophy is always there. And I'll say too, like one of the guys who influenced the practical philosophy movement, Pierre Hadot, he calls it philosophy as a way of life. So this form of inquiry, being in the question, having that Socratic ignorance, being poetically attuned, it's like I'm always in it in a way. It's just like I don't leave it. And when I feel like I do leave it, it's something feels off. And I feel like you can be in that state in a way that's compatible with getting things done in the world and being agentic in the world.
I mean, I'm thinking of like action inquiry as well, which I read that book a long time ago, but it was like that combination of action, but each action is an inquiry in a sense. It's revealing more of one's self and constructions and ways of being in the world, and that can be a real joy to that. It's not like a kind of, of course all processes have challenging aspects to them at times, but I want to, like, is there any other of the principles you want to bring in? Because there's some other brilliant ones. I want to let you self-select. I want to ask about the mystical, if we have time, a bit after that. It does come to me, but I want to see if there are any other of the principles first.
I can name them, and then if anyone resonates with you, we can go deep in it. But after the definitions, there's like a kind of concepts, or I call concepts unfolding, understand the person's concept. There's a dialectic, understanding, maybe if there's a dialectic present, I call creating a two by two or a two by two foo, as I like to call it, where you have two axes and with like opposing extremes, and then it gives you like an understanding of a slice of reality. Forming arguments, this is like the basis. All inquiries, philosophical inquiries, lead to argumentation. And then there's like a this notion of a theory sketch. Like, so if you have these, if you define a word, you have a dialectic, you have a two by two, and you have arguments that support it all, then basically you have a theory. But this is not like a theoretical philosophy where the theory is detached from what's meaningful and what's situated and what's personal. It's like a provisional theory sketch that you can throw away, but it helps you navigate life, or the life that's in front of you. So in my understanding of practical philosophy, we are doing theory, but it's a very practical oriented theory, that's based off of like an existential knot or what's really bothering a person. And so after the X knot, I like to get these sort of like theory sketches. And like I said, though, it's like you might just need to do one of those techniques and then you're good, right? Maybe you just have to define a word. But sometimes, like, you don't need to do this. It's not wise to continue philosophizing with a person in the way I just articulated. Sometimes it's wiser to pivot to a more coaching modality or a therapeutic modality, or just giving direct advice if you have it, if you have a certain knowledge in the area that they're coming with. And that takes, discernment in order to navigate between all those. And I don't think a perfect system exists, nor should it yet, that would how you can train people. And maybe that's what's unfolding with this inquiry that I'm on. But one insight I had writing this piece in order to prepare myself to talk about it for this podcast is that A philosophical inquiry is different than a wise inquiry. So, a philosophical inquiry, meaning a love of a wisdom inquiry. So, a love of wisdom inquiry is different than a wise inquiry, because a wise inquiry might be just a coaching inquiry or might be just a therapeutic inquiry. You might not need to do too much of these like fancy philosophical techniques that I mentioned. And so, kind of like if you're oriented with the spirit, to the spirit of wisdom or less foolishness, I think that you'll stumble. I've stumbled many times, but I think that affords greater understanding of when to pivot different genres of inquiry.
That's super cool. So that it doesn't become like its own kind of process, which then one has to follow, but you're always kind of remaining kind of attuned to what would serve most, what's practical. That's a wise inquiry. That's so this is why I like this kind of conversation, which takes one out of one domain like coaching and kind of starts to kind of look down from a kind of larger organizing principle onto what would serve this person most. Because I think that that's something maybe as coaches we forget sometimes. If you get too enamored with your own
Yeah,
kind of
yeah.
like training or approach, and then you lose touch with like that it might you might just really miss like in front of you what would most serve that person. Maybe it's something super practical, telling them how you did something or what they could do.
Yeah, totally.
I just want to say it might be good to have you just talk briefly about let me see where what I liked about the kind of 2x2 foo and forming arguments is for people who are looking to engage in a process of like clarifying what might my working philosophy be. I think it's a really powerful kind of almost like playbook for playing around with that. And because you created 2x2s that have, I'm thinking of the one where you talked about agentic sages
Oh,
that have kind of touched a lot of people. I mean, maybe like the 2x2 foo, like just give us a sense of like what possibility you see with that, what you use it for.
yeah. And it's one of those things that it's probably best to like see what the two looks
We
like.
can we'll link in the show notes,
Okay,
and
great.
I mean you can
Yeah.
share on the screen if you want anything for if and when we put this video out.
Great.
If that, but it might be disruptive. So,
So the one that you were referring to, I did this article on agency, what I like high agency to wise agency. So agency, your listeners might know, is like it's like a popular term right now. A lot of people in the startup world, product managers, entrepreneurs are talking about agency, or specifically high agency. And one way to understand agency is like accomplishing things with complex constraints. And so, like, these Steve Jobs, Elon Musk, these are like, despite whatever criticisms you can put on it, these are quite agentic individuals because they're accomplishing complex things in the world. But you can be a foolish agent, and not necessarily a wise one. And so I created this 2x2, where on one axis there's a high agency and the other extreme is low agency. And then on the y-axis is a high consciousness versus low consciousness, or you can put wisdom or foolishness there as well. And then you get four different quadrants, and then you can populate each quadrant with a term. And then so the term of, like, let's say wisdom and then high agency, I called it the agentic sage. And then with high agency and foolishness, I coined it agentic fools. And so it's like, the agentic sage is the ideal. It's aligned, awake, effective. And the agentic fool is, hustles hard but lacks wisdom, dangerous in leadership. The other quadrant was interesting, the people who are like, let's say, wise or have high consciousness, but they have low agency. Is like I put the term spiritual bypasser, but maybe we can come up with a different term there. But they're like they're very insightful, but it's like they're not acting in a way that's unfolding their potential. So there's what Dostoevsky calls like overwise, being overwise. You have genuine insights that you can point to things, but you're it's not embodied or fully developed in a way that allows you to be an agent in the world. So of course these 2x2s, you can disagree with them, you can argue with them, that's the whole point. But it's I create them as a theory sketch again, as something just provisional to just help unlock something. And then the thing that particular 2x2 that I mentioned that helped unlock is that, oh, there's such a thing as being highly agentic and being a fool, which I think is helpful for the people who are just like worshiping that meme right now of high agency and then the startup and AI community. I'm like, wait a minute. Yeah, agency can be good, but it also can be bad. Same thing with discipline. You can discipline yourself in a way that like leads to burnout or injury. So the value of discipline is not always good. And so one distinction I have too is like a value, an intentional protocol as I defined it before, versus a virtue. And I understand virtue as a value that's always good. And so I think that's an important distinction because a lot of these things that people talk about, whether it's high agency or discipline, it's a value, not a virtue.
Yeah, th this is great. How would you how do you do this, and how would you invite others playing around to play around with this to find the dialectic, or the kind of what you would put on the axes, you know?
That's that might come to sort of like training, the question of training or education, because I took a philosophy background and I've read a lot of philosophy, all these like intellectual type books. And I think and if you just read those books without having the more embodied spiritual practices that I've also have been doing, then you just become like a disembodied, philosopher that's like creates abstract theories that no one can really resonate with or relate in the broader sense. And so like the combination of those two worlds are important. But I share that because I've had a lot of experience just following my interest and curiosity that developed a capacity for abstraction and kind of a conceptual competence, as some people call it. And I'm not saying everyone needs conceptual confidence. Like maybe it's a sort of like a certain type of person that's oriented towards it. That could be their piece or their way to serve. But I do think it can be trained and developed. But I haven't. And I think these kind of techniques and tools could be like a good start, like a good sketch to figure out maybe a practice behind it to develop it. But I don't have a clear answer of how to practice 2x2 foo. There's one I have called concept unfolding, like how to like unfold a new concept. And there's a Stoa session by my friend Nick Benjamin who had this like crazy practice on how to do it, which so there's people that are like experimenting with stuff like this. But the ideally education at its best, hopefully would afford these capacities.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, I can see that. And I mean, I can imagine, you could just take something that you've been wrestling with, like in, high consciousness, high agency, or this axis of agency and consciousness has a kind of tension inside of it, doesn't it? It's like, and you might polarize between one side or another. So yeah, maybe for people that can feel like they're wrestling themselves with their own, like authority, might
Exactly, yeah.
like lend itself to being something like that. So yeah, what I like about it again is it's like a way of kind of making what's half conscious, what's implicit, and therefore structuring our world more explicit, so one. This, like, a lot of our conversation actually points to me towards agentic saging, as a verb, that I'm starting to kind of be a kind of magician. I'm starting to uncover the structures of myself and the world and presence them, and therefore I can kind of tune them or change them and become more of an agentic sage.
Yeah. And that particular two by two in that article I wrote, it traveled on like Twitter and people like kind of modified it, changed the wording. And I think that is resonating with the collective is because there's a lot of bypassing that happens. You know, like spiritual bypassing is a term people who engage in like deep meditation or perhaps some kind of psychedelics when they really should be focusing on something else, like maybe healing or some therapy work. But then there's also like therapeutic bypassing where people can kind of endlessly engage in therapy and parts work and this and that. But maybe you should just like, you know, clean your room or like get out of the house. So, you know, if the house is burning, you don't need to do parts work, you just leave. You can be self-help bypass, all kinds of bypassing. And the idea of wisdom, especially if it's the meta value, it allows for that discernment to choose what the appropriate value is. Because again, a value is not a virtue. A value could be foolish, but it also could be wise, depending on the context. And so I feel like the wisdom talent stack or the philosophical inquiry, especially a practical philosophical inquiry, helps create greater understanding and discernment of what value to choose and when. And I think sort of like that for myself, like, you know, how the authority, I imagine there's something about your relationship to authority that kind of calls you to like sense into, in a philosophical sense, what does that actually mean? And then if you get a stronger understanding of it, that might inform how it shows up in your life and how you can practice it better. And the same thing, like this term agency, which just felt like it was calling me forward, because what I'm called to do in the world now, start a business, be more forthright in talking about my practice, like I'm doing now, it demands a certain level of agency. But then on one hand, if you just read sort of like classic self-help books, Tony Robbins type stuff, it's like there's some stuff there that you can definitely recognize that works and it's effective. But if you follow it fully without it being examined, it just feels like, okay, this is kind of foolish. I feel like I'm being bent out of integrity, or I'll put myself in a situation that will compromise my integrity because now I'm this kind of system that's corrupting me. So just following the best practices of how to like be a successful life coach or this or that, it's like, or how to run a successful podcast. Like, I don't know if I want to do that. But I am called to do something. And the other end is like, I don't want to like just keep like meditating or doing this or doing like, you know, therapy type work. That just kind of creates like a over wisdom, in a way, being overwise. That's not kind of like meets reality. And so it's like, how do we kind of honor, you know, the signal of those two things, the agentic fool and like the bypasser, and have this North Star. And I think that's what resonated with people is that, there's a conceptual North Star now. We don't know how to be an agentic sage, but we know we're called to be it because we don't want to be these two other things.
You know, that it's funny as you share this, it's like I'm realizing why that 2x4 resonated with me, and my own journey, which has been around like, you know, getting into meditation and spirituality, but quite quickly feeling like I'm an immediate call to like being of service in the world. So, you know, like I want to be useful and
Right.
enjoy my life and be effective and for life to feel wholesome rather than, you know, kind of transcend the world. So there's something about that kind of confluence of like acting in the world, but, you know, in alignment with one's greatest sense of calling and understanding and commitment to live fully, that feels like very thrilling and perhaps like perhaps one of the deep callings of our time.
This is interesting, because it's, so this is something that's my edge now. Well, pretty much everything I talked about today is at my edge, but this is also at my edge. is this feeling of being useful versus being useless. And notices this theme. And it's really great, as you probably know. I'm surely you do know, when in your practice, you get like your coaching practice or whatever, it's a space holding practice. You get a sense of the wider world, because it's like the individual, what they're struggling with, it's like a microcosm to what's happening in the world. And then there's certain patterns that happen. So like my output, let's say my more theoretical output on my less foolish Substack, is informed often on the inquiries that I'm having. And one theme that's coming up right now is like a kind of a segment of my client base are pretty much agentic men who are have a philosophical opening, or they had like a spiritual emergency, and so they're like they have the scent of wisdom, and then they have a background of being agentic, but then they're like confused on how to move forward. And one of the underlying fears there is the feeling of being useless, and not, I think it's particularly like prevalent amongst men, a certain type of men. There's this feeling of being useless and not of service. And I think this issue is coming up more and more is AI. AI is going to, it is changing the game, and it's going to be revealed basically every day of how it's changing the game. And if it's true, there's going to be mass, unemployment, if or certain fields could just go be irrelevant and obsolete. And so I think people are sensing that in the social field, the wider social field, and it's directly confronting this sense of being useless, essentially, which is a terrible thing to feel. Because if you look at it through an evolutionary lens, if you're useless for the tribe, goodbye, we don't need you anymore. And so I think this is why a lot of people are talking about wisdom today, because it's just not about being useful, especially unexaminedly useful.
What just to stay with this, like, what have you noticed in your inquiries, I mean, or your own life around that question of being useful? Where does it take you? This question might be a little vague, so I don't know if it lands for you, but is it a useful question? Like, to but it, because I the reason I ask is, you know, I think like I can resonate with this, you know, like the AI coming in, you know, what's going to happen to making a living, you know, this is going to really fundamental. It's already having us question things on a very fundamental level. So we're in a collective X knot in a way, and this seems at the one of the core inquiries.
I think so I had, like, last summer I had this like just processed. I was in a situation where I was feeling useless. And I'm like, you know what? I'm not gonna run away from this feeling. I'm just gonna like sit with it. And yeah, underneath that feeling of being useless is like a fear of not being loved, essentially. Because if I'm not of service, I'm not useful for others, then I'll just get rejected. And so that was a great opportunity to do essentially parts work on various different elements that were at play there, and just come to like a more holistic love of myself. And I felt like something kind of unlocked. Now this is sort of not an issue for me, in a way. And I feel like I can sense it in others, this underlying anxiety that they don't want to meet. And it's a, like a prevalent challenge amongst men. Like, the classic thing that their wife or their partner is, going through something, and they just want to like be heard. But then they go into a solution mode, like, oh, do this, do this, do this. That's sort of like this instinct of being useful, in a way that's actually harmful to the relationship. And so I think if you don't like have this like practice of self-love, and this is where, therapy is very useful, and you're just like useful bypassing in a way, right? Then you're kind of like, it's going to be a category error, and it's going to be doing more harm than good. And so this is why I think, in order to have a wise inquiry, we got to have all these different modalities at play, in order to make a wise or less foolish person.
A recent retreat I was on, I also contacted a sense of I think the general if I don't go into that reflection, but it's the collective invitation into how we constructed our identity around what brings us love and a sense of belonging, and that the way you describe meeting it is what opens the door for transformation around that. So each kind of word, like being useful, is a kind of, again, a doorway into like a transformation, a possible transformation. Can I ask you, because as we move towards the end of our time, I do want to bring in the mystical in the sense of, maybe I don't want to feel take us into the mystical weeds, but something I'm reflecting on, why I bring it in, is because one thing I wrestle with is I've always kind of held this position in my coaching, which is like, I'm coaching you, and I'm supporting you to find your way, to find more wisdom, find more clarity. But it's basically us two in the session, yeah. And more recently, the experiences I've had has been like opening to a sense of the divine, to a sense of support, and I don't bring that into my coaching yet because I'm like, I don't want to impose any kind of belief system onto my clients. And yet, at the same time, the experience is one of like, wow, like increasingly it's difficult to ignore, and it's like a kind of great intelligence or a sense of support. So that is really prefacing the question of like, how does the mystical have a place in your philosophical inquiry? Yeah.
100%. As I mentioned to you before we pressed the record button, is I was baptized as a Orthodox Christian, and I drifted away from the church when I was in high school, university, and philosophy, the one that I'm critical of now, the overtly theoretical philosophy, was a part of that. I recently returned essentially to the church, and specifically drawn to Orthodox Christianity. And what I love about Orthodoxy is they have such a rich, strong, mystical tradition. I remember my babushka. I'm half Ukrainian, half German, and on my German side, or my Ukrainian side, that's where the Orthodoxy came from. And when I was in her presence, it was just like there's like a thickness in the air. You just like it's almost like she was swimming in God in a way, So I just it's just like, and it's interesting, the Orthodox understanding of God, they're panentheistic. They're not theistic, meaning that like God is not out there, but like God is within and without. And so it's like that swimming in God thing. I think that's why
Beautiful.
my babushka, she was in a tradition that that was embedded in God. So I feel like something about Orthodoxy just lands for me quite right. Because it has that mystical component, it's not detached from it. Like I said, I was having when I wrote this three-part series in order to prepare for this podcast, I had a little bit of an existential crisis because the framing of it was all established during my non-Christian days. So I had like a secular framing. And now I'm having these this emerging Christianity. It's about a year ago since we started going to the church. And I call myself more identified myself as an aspiring Christian, because just merely identifying one as one is I don't think is enough. You have to be a true follower. And just this weekend, I had this real like kind of experience with my wife, I'll keep it private between us. But I was like, oh man, how do I like navigate this like mysticism, and then like and just tradition that I love with this philosophy I love and this practice. And I feel like, I've managed to connect it to the last couple of days. But to kind of answer your question more explicitly, that in some inquiries, the most inquiries, but people who have a capacity for this sort of like deeper realm, it's like I'm a vessel for something else, that's flowing through me. God in the language that I'm gaining accustomed to. or the Holy Spirit. It's like something is flowing through me, and I'm just a vessel for greater clarity. And when someone else has like greater capacity, you just feel that thickness that I felt with my babushka in that inquiry, and just like something just flows, and it's like very graceful. And so, yeah, my edge, I'm incorporating prayer in my form of inquiry, because the prayer, at least from the Orthodox tradition, the understanding there is aligning one's will with God's will, rather than aligning one's will with, their ego, which is more like magic with a K, or like law of attraction type stuff, manifestation, which I think has, there's an efficacy there, and it has its place, but it's different than prayer, understood, the way I articulated it. So yeah, I think it's definitely there's a mystical side here, and I'm very attracted to mystical Christianity, and it's again something that's at my edge.
Yeah, thanks for sharing that. As you speak, there's something about, when we talk about words, concepts as portals, it's like now it's like within this frame of, God in a sense. Like there's a kind of frequency. Like these words are not just concepts or even just embodied metaphors, or that, but there's a kind of, there's a frequency inside of these words there. And I'm not quite sure what I'm trying to say, but it's like this sense of grace, that can come through when two people come together and kind of love their experience, and that something can open up in the way you're talking about and kind of permeate that experience, and there is that feeling of grace and magic. So, glad you brought that in. Or maybe I brought it in, but then you
You probably,
responded.
yeah. Thanks for noticing.
Is there anything you want to share at all to end with? Anything comes to you? There's no need, but I'm going to ask you in a moment where we can find out more about your work,
Okay,
but I'm
the
thinking
top.
now more about just, anything that comes to you.
I'm the I got invited to be a philosopher in residence at this AI collective. It's like the largest AI group in the world. And so I just starting next week. And so this theme of uselessness, usefulness, and then the underlying anxiety with the AI conversation, it's quite important to me, and understanding how I could bring in philosophical inquiry and this mysticism that we were speaking of in that, that field, the AI field. And so that's sort of at my edge. And a lot of different things are at my edge right now, as I mentioned, like doing something called the anti-debate, doing inverse courses. So, I'll just like tease people with those little terms, and they can look me up and see it. But other than that, just grateful for this conversation, and it felt right saying yes to it, and breaking the my podcasting hiatus with you, my friend.
Well, yeah, so glad you did. So glad you did. Thank you, Peter. It's been just a really enjoyable conversation. Really pleased to be sharing this. Yeah. What's the name of your Substack again?
It's less foolish, so lessfoolish.substack.com. Yeah, I have a active inquiry practice, practical philosophy inquiry practice, so people can check out my website, which you can include in the show notes. And the Stoa, I have this place called the Stoa. It's the Stoa.ca. There's also a YouTube channel, and we have events. There's going to be courses, and it's a very I think it's a mix of like practical philosophy and kind of cultural sense making. That's how I understand it. And we have a couple cool sessions coming up. One is high archetypal penetrance by I think it's like, what is his name, Tim something, but that's a cool session. And so it's still sort of like an informal kind of school, if you will. That's what it feels like. It's forming wisdom school, maybe. So yeah, those are three things that are active projects of mine that I'm happy to draw attention to, is the Substack, my writing, my philosophy practice, and then the Stoa.
Yeah, fantastic. Thanks for tuning into the podcast. I really hope you enjoyed it. And a reminder that the early bird enrollment is now open for our upcoming live training with Jim Dethmer and Bob Anderson. It's called Unlocking Leaders, and it's going to teach you how to coach at the level of consciousness, which is for me the highest leverage move you can make as a coach. Your client's consciousness is the place where the deepest, truest transformational breakthroughs come from. And often traditional coaching misses this. And it's something that our clients need us to learn as coaches. Because our times are calling for something deeper. We've got to go beneath the content of our experience, beneath strategy, to the source of change. And that's exactly what Unlocking Leaders is designed to teach you. I'm so proud of this program, of what it's become. I feel it's our offering in these times. And if you're ready to answer the call of these times, then you can join the full program. So just head to coachesrising.com/leaders to book your spot. And remember, you can get the early bird discount if you join by 29th of May. Here we are. We're at the end of the podcast. Just a heads up again. If you're not on our mailing list and you want to stay in the loop about other things we create, then head to coachesrising.com. Put your name in the sign up box there. You'll also find some of our other offerings, our online trainings for coaches there. And just want to end by wishing you well, and I'll see you again next time.